Welcome to the deep dive. We take your learning materials, break them down, and pull out the key insights for you. Think of it like a shortcut to understanding what really counts.
That's right. We're here to sort of navigate all that information, really highlighting the concepts you absolutely need to know.
And today, our mission is, well, it's very specific. We've got a listener who's prepping for their NLP final exam.
Ah, final season. Fun times.
Indeed. And they've shared their class notes with us, which look great, by the way, packed with essential stuff.
So our goal for this deep dive is basically to synthesize those notes. We want to make the core ideas super clear, give you a really solid foundation for that exam.
Yeah, we're kind of creating your ultimate study guide, but, you know, in audio form.
Exactly.
Let's be real. Facing a final exam, it can feel like you're just drowning in information.
Right? Absolutely. Overwhelming.
But don't worry. We've got your back. We have the two files here, 5,300 practice exam notes, 1.pdf, and the condensed Google Doc version. We're ready to extract that crucial knowledge.
We'll keep a good pace, cover all the key areas, but always focusing on making it clear and understandable. This is your fast track to nailing those NLP concepts for the exam.
Okay, let's dive in then. First up, Module 1, Sentiment Analysis and Classification. So in NLP, what exactly is classification? Let's start there.
Right. So classification at its core is really just about assigning a specific category to some input. It's fundamental across AI, not just NLP.
Okay.
In natural language processing, when we talk about text categorization or text classification, the idea is to take some text, could be a sentence, could be a whole document, and give it a label from a predefined set.
Like sorting emails, you mentioned that.
Exactly like sorting emails. Important, yeah. Spam, social, whatever. That's classification right there.
That makes sense. So how does sentiment analysis fit into this classification picture?
Sentiment analysis is really just a specific, very common type of text classification. The main goal here is to figure out the emotional tone or the attitude expressed in some writing.
Towards what? Like a product.
Yeah, towards a particular object. Could be a product, a service, a person, an event, you name it. We're basically trying to classify the text as, say, positive, negative, or maybe neutral.
Gotcha. So for the exam, remember sentiment analysis, text classification, but the categories are opinions, emotions.
Precisely. That's the key takeaway.
Okay, so if you want to build a system that does sentiment analysis, what are the common ways to go about it? What strategies are there?
Well, there are a few main strategies. One pretty straightforward way is looking for lexical cues.
Specific words.
Yeah, words that just carry a positive or negative vibe, you know,
yeah.
Like amazing or excellent, clearly positive, or terrible. Awful, negative.
Right.
Then there's supervised machine learning. That's where we train algorithms on data that's already been labeled. So text examples tagged with their sentiment.
Positive, negative, neutral labels.
Exactly. Another tool is sentiment lexicons. These are basically dictionaries of words that have pre-assigned sentiment scores.
Think a big list of happy and sad words.
Sort of, yeah, often with scores. And finally, a really important one is handling negation.
Like not good.
Right. Saying not good completely flips the sentiment of good. So you need techniques to catch that. A common one is adding a prefix like not to words that follow a negation word. Helps the model understand the reversal.
Okay, good point. Now, you mentioned supervised learning, and the notes really dig into naive Bayes. How does that work for classifying sentiment?
Okay, naive Bayes.
Yeah.
It's a probabilistic classifier. It works based on Bayes' rule, a really core concept in probability. Mm-hmm. But it makes a couple of, well, naive simplifying assumptions about the data.
Hence the name.
Hence the name. So for a given document, let's call it D, we want to find the class that's the sentiment, like positive or negative, that's most probable given the document.
Okay.
Bayes' rule gives us the formula, PCD, PCD.
Right. Probability of the class given the document equals probability of document given class times probability of class divided by probability of document.
Exactly. But since PDC, the probability of seeing that specific document is the same no matter which sentiment C we're considering, we can simplify. We just need to find the class that maximizes the numerator, PDC, PC.
Okay, maximize the probability of the document given the class times the overall probability of the class. That's the core idea. So what are these naive assumptions it makes?
Two key ones. First is the bag of words assumption.
We mentioned that briefly. Word order doesn't matter.
Correct. It treats the document like a bag. You just dump all the words out and count them. The sequence is ignored. Just the presence and frequency matter.
Okay. And the second?
The second is the assumption of conditional independence. This is a big one. It assumes that the probability of seeing a particular word in a document given a specific sentiment class is independent of all the other words in that document given that same class.
So knowing excellent is in a positive review doesn't change the probability of seeing amazing in that same review, according to the model.
Basically, yes. Mathematically, it's PF1, F2, FMNC, PF2C, PF2C, where the S are features, like words.
Right. Ignores word order and assumes words don't influence each other within a class. Definitely simplifies things. How do we actually use this to predict sentiment, then?
So to classify, Naive Bayes calculates a score for each possible sentiment C. It takes the prior probability of that sentiment PC, like how common positive reviews are overall, and multiplies it by the probability of each word W in the document D, given that sentiment PWC.
For all the words in the document.
Yep, multiplies all those PWs together. So the classification, CNB, is the class C that maximizes this whole product. CNB, argmax, average, B, WC.
Okay, multiply the prior by the product of word probabilities for each class, pick the biggest.
Exactly. Now, in practice, multiplying lots of small probabilities can lead to tiny numbers, computational underflow, so we usually work in log space.
Ah, logs turn multiplication into addition, right?
Precisely. So the formula becomes CNB, argmax, sings P, plus Aichi positions, log P, wick. You just sum the log probabilities instead. Much more stable and faster.
Log space. Got it. Now, the notes also bring up the problem of zero probabilities. What's that about and how do we deal with it?
Right. This is super important practically. Imagine you're classifying a new review and it contains a word, say, stellar, that just never appeared in any negative reviews in your training data.
Okay.
If you just calculate the probability P, stellar negative, based on the training counts, it'll be zero.
And because Naive Bayes multiplies probabilities.
The whole probability for the negative class becomes zero, just because of that one unseen word, which is obviously not right. The review might still be negative overall.
So how do we fix that? Smoothing?
Exactly, smoothing. Add one smoothing, also called Laplace smoothing, is a common simple way. You basically pretend you've seen every word in your vocabulary one extra time for each class.
Just add one to all the counts.
Pretty much. The formula for the smooth probability P becomes count YC plus 1, count WC plus 1, where V is the whole vocabulary.
So the numerator is the count of the word plus 1, and the denominator is the total count of words in that class plus the total number of unique words in the vocabulary.
You got it. This guarantees that even words unseen in the training data for a specific class get a small non-zero probability. Keeps the whole calculation from collapsing.
Makes sense. A little tweak to keep things robust. Okay, let's switch gears to measuring how well our sentiment classifier is actually doing. Metrics. What's the starting point here?
The confusion matrix. It's fundamental for evaluating any classification model. It's just a table that compares the model's predictions to the actual true labels.
Giving us a breakdown of where it's right and where it's wrong.
Exactly. For a binary task, like positive-negative sentiment, it has four cells. True positives, TP, correctly predicted positive. False positives, FP, incorrectly predicted positive. It was actually negative. False negatives, FN, incorrectly predicted negative. It was actually positive. And true negatives, TN, correctly predicted negative.
TP, FP, FN, TN. Got it. And now the notes stress that accuracy, just the percentage of correct predictions, isn't always the best metric. Why not?
Yeah, accuracy, calculated as TP plus TN, TP plus SP plus TN plus FNI, can be super misleading, especially with imbalanced data sets.
Imbalanced meaning way more examples of one class than another.
Exactly. Imagine trying to detect a rare disease, maybe 1% prevalence. A dumb model that always predicts no disease gets 99% accuracy.
Wow, yeah. Sounds great, but it's totally useless because it never finds the actual cases.
Precisely. Same in sentiment analysis. If 95% of your reviews are positive, a model predicting positive all the time gets 95% accuracy, but completely fails on the negative ones. Accuracy doesn't tell the whole model.
Right, doesn't capture that nuance. So that brings us to precision and recall. How do they give us a better picture?
They look at different aspects of performance. Precision asks, of all the times the system predicted positive, how often was it actually correct? The formula is precision, TP, TP plus FP.
So high precision means fewer false positives. When it says positive, it's usually right.
Exactly. Recall, on the other hand, asks, of all the actual positive cases, how many did the system correctly identify? The formula is recall, PP, TP plus FN.
High recall means fewer false negatives. It finds most of the true positives.
Correct. Precision is about the accuracy of positive predictions. Recall is about finding all the positive instances.
And there's often a trade-off between these two, isn't there?
Absolutely. Very common trade-off. If you tune your system to be very cautious, only predicting positive when it's extremely confident to maximize precision, you'll probably miss some actual positive cases, lowering your recall.
And vice versa.
If you try to catch every single positive instance, maximize recall, you'll likely misclassify some negative ones as positive, which hurts your precision.
Okay, so we need a way to balance them. That's the F score, right? What is it?
Yeah, the F score, or F measure, combines precision and recall into a single metric. It's the harmonic mean of the two. The general formula is FEF plus one precision recall, and precision plus recall.
Whoa, what's the beta?
The beta parameter lets you control the weighting. If you care more about recall, you use a beta greater than one. If you care more about precision, beta is less than one.
And if they're equally important.
Then you set beta to 1, which gives you the most common version, the S score. Evero 2, precision recall, precision plus recall.
Okay, the harmonic mean. Why is that useful?
It gives a balanced measure. A system needs both high precision and high recall to get a high F score. If either one is very low, the F score will also be low. It's especially useful when false positives and false negatives are roughly equally bad for your application.
Got it. So Evio is a nice single number summarizing that precision recall balance. Great. Module 1 feels pretty well covered. Let's move to Module 2, text normalization. What's the big idea here?
Text normalization is all about converting raw text into a more standard, consistent format. It's usually one of the very first steps in an NLP pipeline.
Why do we need to do that?
Because real-world text is messy. You have variations in capitalization, punctuation, spelling, word forms. Normalization cleans this up, reduces the variability, which makes it easier for later steps like analysis or modeling to work effectively. Think of it as tidying up before you analyze.
Okay, tidying up. What are the typical cleaning steps involved?
Several key ones. First, tokenization, breaking the text stream into individual units, usually words and punctuation. These units are called tokens.
Splitting sentences into words, basically.
Yeah, that's the main idea. Then, normalizing word formats. This includes things like case folding, making everything lowercase, for example.
So Apple and Apple become the same?
Exactly. And standardizing forms, like maybe I was using USA instead of USA or US. Then there's sentence segmentation, splitting the text into individual sentences.
Finding sentence boundaries.
Right. And finally, limitization, or stemming, reducing words to their base or root form.
Okay, limitization and stemming, they sound similar. What's the key difference?
They both aim to get rid of inflectional endings like ing or ed to group related words together, but they do it differently. Limitization is the more sophisticated one.
How so?
It uses a dictionary and morphological analysis to find the actual dictionary headword, the lemma. So for running, ran, runs, the lemma is run. It produces real words.
Okay, and stemming?
Stemming is cruder. It often just uses rules to chop off common prefixes or suffixes. It doesn't care if the result is a real word or not. So walking might become walk, which is fine, but it can mess up. It might turn policy and police into the same stem, Pollock, that's overgeneralization. Or it might fail to relate European and Europe that's undergeneralization. Stemming is faster, computationally cheaper, but less accurate linguistically.
So lemma is the dictionary form. Stem is just a chopped off version.
Got it. You also mentioned sentence segmentation. Splitting the sentences. Seems easy, just split it periods, question marks, exclamation points.
Ah, if only. Periods are the tricky ones. They don't just end sentences, right?
Oh, yeah. Abbreviations like Mr. or Inc. or numbers like 3.14 URLs.
Exactly. www.google.com has periods. So just splitting on every period would break things apart incorrectly all the time. It's ambiguous.
Right. So how do we handle that ambiguity properly?
Several ways. You can use rule-based approaches like a period followed by a capital letter is more likely to be a sentence end, but not always. You can use lists, abbreviation dictionaries, to know that ink followed by a period isn't the end of a sentence.
Makes sense. Check against a list.
Or more advanced techniques use machine learning. You train a classifier to look at the context around a period word's before and after, capitalization is the word in an abbreviation list, and predict, is this period a sentence boundary or not? So train a model specifically for period disambiguation. Okay, let's move on to Module 3, probabilistic language models. What's the core idea behind these?
A probabilistic language model, or LM, tries to compute the probability of a sequence of words. Basically, how likely is a given sentence or phrase in a particular language?
Like, is the cat sat on the mat more probable than Matt the onsat cat?
Exactly. It captures these statistical patterns of how words typically sequence together. They can also be used to predict the next word in a sequence, given the words that came before it. That's fundamental for things like predictive text or speech recognition.
How is this different from classification, which we started with?
Different goal. Classification assigns a category to the whole text. Language modeling assigns a probability to the sequence itself or predicts the next item in the sequence. It's about the structure and flow of language, not just labeling.
Okay, and how do they work? The notes focus on n-gram models. What's an n-gram?
An n-gram is just a sequence of n consecutive items from text, usually words. So a 1 gram is a unigram, a single word, a 2 gram is a big gram, 2 words, 3 gram is a trigram, 3 words, and so on.
The cat sat on, those are big grams for my example.
Precisely. They're the basic building blocks for these models.
So how do n-gram models use these to estimate sentence probability?
They rely on something called the Markov assumption. It simplifies the problem massively. Instead of looking at the entire preceding history of words to predict the next one, a Markov assumption of order n1 says the probability of the current word depends only on the previous n1 words.
So a big gram model, N2, assumes the probability of a word depends only on the one word immediately before it.
Exactly. A trigram model depends on the previous 2 words. So to approximate the probability of a whole sentence, W1.WN, you multiply the conditional probabilities, P, Bobby1.WN.
Oh, why?
The predictive probabilities of each word given its N1 predecessors. Right, and how do we get those conditional probabilities, like PY1 for a B-gram model? We estimate them from a large training corpus using maximum likelihood estimation, or MLE.
Just counting.
Pretty much. For B-grams, PYY1 is estimated as count YY1, count Y1. How often did the sequence Y1Y appear, divided by how often Y1 appeared?
And for unigrams, just count Y, total words.
Yep. Simple frequency counts.
But again, what about sequences we've never seen in the training data? The zero probability problem strikes again.
It absolutely does. If a specific B-gram, say crystalline structure, never occurred in your training text, its MLE probability is zero. And that makes any sentence containing it have zero probability. Not good.
So we need smoothing again, like in naive Bayes.
Yes, but the techniques are often a bit different for language models. Add one smoothing, which we discussed, isn't ideal here because it tends to steal too much probability mass from the frequent n-grams and gives too much to the unseen ones.
Okay, so what's better?
More sophisticated methods are common. Interpolation mixes probabilities from different n-gram orders. Like, you combine the trigram probability, the B-gram probability, and the unigram probability using some weights called lambdas.
So you blend the estimates.
Right. Another approach is back off. If you have good evidence for a higher order n-gram, like a trigram count is high enough, you use its probability. If not, you back off and use a lower order probability, like a B-gram, maybe with some discount.
Okay, clever ways to handle unseen n-grams. But are there deeper limitations to n-gram models, even with smoothing?
Oh, definitely. A major one is they can't capture long-distance dependencies. Because they only look back N1 words, they miss relationships between words far apart in a sentence.
Like subject-verb agreement when there are clauses in between.
Exactly, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Also, their performance really depends on how similar the training data is to the test data. If you train on news articles and test on tweets, performance will likely drop. And fundamentally, they don't really understand grammar or meaning, just surface-level co-occurrence statistics.
Right, so how do we measure how good a language model is? The notes mention perplexity. What's that?
Perplexity is the standard intrinsic evaluation metric for language models. It measures how well the model predicts a test set it hasn't seen before.
How well? Higher or lower is better?
Lower perplexity is better. You can think of it as the model being less perplexed or surprised by the test set. Mathematically, it's the inverse probability of the test set, normalized by the number of words.
Inverse probability.
Yeah. The formula for a test set W1W2.WN is PPWANONW1NASH1F.
Okay, probability of the whole sequence, raised to the power of -1 over the number of words.
Right, and using the chain rule or n-gram approximation for PW, you can calculate it. For a big-gram model, it's PPWARI1NPYY-1NN.
So lower perplexity means the model assigned higher probability on average to the actual words in the test set. Why is this useful?
It gives us a quantitative way to compare different LMs. If model A has lower perplexity than model B on the same test set, model A is generally considered better at modeling that data. It's a quick way to assess generalization without needing a full downstream task evaluation.
But it's not the only measure, right?
No, definitely not. The ultimate test is extrinsic evaluation. How well does the LM improve performance in a real application like translation or speech recognition? But perplexity is a very useful and common intrinsic metric. Just be aware it doesn't always perfectly correlate with downstream performance.
Okay, that's a solid look at probabilistic language models. Let's shift to Module 4, meaning representations. This sounds like we're moving beyond just word sequences to actual meaning.
Exactly. We want ways to represent what words and texts mean so computers can work with that meaning. We need representations that capture semantic relationships, like which words are similar, opposite, or related in other ways.
How do we even begin to represent meaning? The notes talk about vector space models.
Vector space models are a cornerstone here. The core idea is to represent words, or sometimes documents, as points or vectors in a high-dimensional space.
Vectors.
Yeah.
Like arrows in space.
Kind of, yeah. Mathematical vectors. And the key principle behind how we build these is the distributional hypothesis.
Ah, we touched on this. You shall know a word by the company it keeps.
That's the one. The idea is that words appearing in similar contexts tend to have similar meanings. So if we analyze how words co-occur in massive amounts of text, we can learn vector representations, where vectors close together in the space correspond to words with similar meanings.
So we learn meaning from usage patterns, from the data itself. How do we actually build these vectors from co-occurrence?
A couple of basic ways. One is a term document matrix. Each row is a word, term, each column is a document. The cell value is often the count of how many times that word appears in that document.
So a word's vector is its pattern of usage across documents.
Yep. Another way is a term matrix or word context matrix. Here, both rows and columns are words from the vocabulary. The cell value, I, J, tells you how often word J appeared near word I in the text.
Near meaning within a certain window.
Exactly. You define a context window, like maybe 5 words to the left and 5 to the right. Then you count co-occurrences within that window across your whole corpus. Each word's vector represents the other words it typically hangs out with.
Okay. Now, the notes distinguish between sparse and dense vectors. What's that about?
The vectors you get directly from these term document or term matrices are usually sparse.
Meaning
they're very high dimensional. The length of the vector is the size of your vocabulary, which can be huge, tens or hundreds of thousands. And most of the entries in the vector are zero, because most words don't appear in most documents or don't co-occur with most other words.
Lots of zeros. And dense.
Dense vectors, like the ones from methods like Word2Vec, which we'll get to, are much shorter, maybe 50 to 1,000 dimensions, typically a few hundred. And crucially, most of the elements are non-zero real numbers.
Do dense vectors work better?
Generally, yes. They seem to capture more subtle semantic relationships, and they're often more useful as input features for downstream machine learning models. The individual dimensions aren't easily interpretable, but the overall vector works well.
Can we improve those basic sparse co-occurrence vectors?
Definitely. For term-term matrices, using those context windows helps capture local relationships. For term document matrices, TF-IDF weighting is very common.
TF-IDF. Term frequency inverse document frequency, remind me.
Right. It boosts the weight of words that are frequent in a specific document, TF, but rare across the entire collection of documents.
Right.
This highlights words that are distinctive or characteristic of a document.
Okay. And for term matrices?
A common technique is using positive pointwise mutual information, or PPMI. It measures how much more often two words co-occur than you'd expect just by chance, based on their individual frequencies. It gives higher scores to words that are strongly associated and downweights very frequent but less informative words like the or a.
So various ways to refine the counts. Once we have these vectors, how do we measure meaning similarity between words? Like how similar are the vectors for cat and dog?
We use similarity metrics on their vectors. Cosine similarity is probably the most popular.
Cosine, like from trigonometry.
Exactly. It measures the cosine of the angle between two vectors. If the vectors point in the exact same direction, the angle is 0, cosine is 1, maximum similarity. If they're orthogonal, 90 degrees, cosine is 0. Opposite directions, cosine is -1.
Why cosine similarity?
A key benefit is that it ignores the magnitude or length of the vectors, focusing only on their orientation. Word frequency can affect vector length, but cosine similarity just cares about the pattern of co-occurrences, which often reflects meaning better.
What about other metrics? Euclidean distance.
You can use Euclidean distance, the straight line distance between the vector endpoints. Smaller distance means more similar, but it is sensitive to vector magnitude, which might not be what you want. Dot products is another option, but it also tends to favor frequent words, which have larger vectors. So cosine is often the go-to for semantic similarity.
Cosine similarity for the win, usually. Okay, that covers vector space models nicely. Leading us into module 5, Word2Vec and neural word embeddings. How does Word2Vec fit in?
Word2Vec is a specific and hugely influential method for learning those dense, low-dimensional word vectors or word embeddings we just talked about.
So it's a way to get dense vectors, not sparse ones.
Exactly. It uses a shallow neural network trained on a large corpus to produce these embeddings, typically a few hundred dimensions. It's computationally efficient and captures semantic relationships remarkably well.
How does it learn them? What's the task?
There are two main Word2Vec architectures. CBOW, continuous bag of words, tries to predict a target word based on its surrounding context words. SkipGram does the opposite. It tries to predict the context words given the target word. The learned weights in the network become the word embeddings.
Okay. The notes specifically highlight SkipGram with negative sampling, SGNS. Can you break that down?
Right. SGNS is a very efficient way to train SkipGram. Instead of trying to predict all context words, which can be slow if the vocabulary is large, it turns the problem into a binary classification task.
Binary, like yes, no.
Exactly. For a given target word and an actual context word that appeared nearby, a positive pair, the model should output yes, or high probability. Then, we create some negative pairs by taking the same target word and pairing it with random words from the vocabulary that didn't appear in its context.
So, target actual context is positive, target random word is negative.
Precisely. We generate maybe 520 negative samples for each positive one. The model, typically a simple logistic regression classifier for each pair, is trained to distinguish the true context words from these random noise words.
And the embeddings come from?
The learned weight vectors for the words used in this classification task are the final embeddings. The loss function essentially tries to maximize the dot product, similarity, between embeddings of words that actually co-occur and minimize it for words that don't. The formula looks something like Li plus Ri equals 1 to K, where W is the target embedding, CPOS is the positive context embedding, KD are negative sample embeddings, and sigma is the sigmoid function.
Okay, train a classifier to tell real context words from fake ones, and the weights become the embeddings. Why did Word2Vec become so popular? What are the advantages over those older matrix methods?
Well, besides being dense and lower dimensional, they generally perform better on various downstream NLP tasks. They seem to capture synonymy and semantic relationships more effectively.
Like placing cat and dog closer than cat and car.
Exactly. But maybe the most talked about benefit is their ability to capture analogies through simple vector arithmetic.
Ah, the famous king, man plus woman and queen example. How does that actually work with the vectors?
It's pretty amazing. It suggests the model learns directions in the embedding space that correspond to semantic concepts. So the vector difference between vector king and vector man seems to capture a royalty concept related to maleness.
And vector queen, vector woman, captures a similar royalty concept for femaleness.
Plausibly, yes. And the difference vector man, vector woman, might represent a gender dimension. So when you do king man plus woman, you're essentially removing the male aspect from king and adding the female aspect, landing you near queen.
That's wild. Does it work for other things?
Yeah, other analogies often work too, like capitals, Paris, France, plus Italy, Rome, mm-hmm. or even verb tenses or comparative adjectives, bigger, big, plus small, smaller. It also suggests some level of vector compositionality combining word vectors might represent phrase meanings, though that's still an active research area.
Fascinating stuff. But the notes also mention a potential downside, biases.
Ah, yes, a critical point. Because these embeddings are learned from real-world text, they unfortunately also learn and reflect the societal biases present in that text.
So like gender stereotypes associated with professions?
Exactly. You might find that analogies like a man is to computer programmer as woman is to homemaker hold true in the embedding space, reflecting historical biases in the training data. This is a major ethical concern and an active area of research, how to create fair and unbiased representations.
Really important consideration. Okay, we've covered word meaning. Let's broaden the scope to Module 6, neural networks. What's the absolute basic building block?
The fundamental unit is the artificial neuron, or sometimes called the perceptron, though modern ones are a bit more complex. It takes some inputs. Each input gets multiplied by a weight.
The weights represent importance.
Sort of, yeah, the strength of the connection. These weighted inputs are summed up. A bias term is added, and the whole result is passed through a nonlinear activation function.
Nonlinear. Why nonlinear?
That's crucial. Without non-linearity, stacking multiple layers wouldn't actually increase the network's expressive power. It would still just be computing a linear function. Non-linear activation functions like sigmoid, tan, or ReLU allow the network to learn complex, non-linear relationships in the data.
Okay, weighted sum plus bias, then a non-linear squashing function. How do we arrange these units?
Typically in layers. You have an input layer, one or more hidden layers, and an output layer. In a basic feedforward network, units in one layer are usually fully connected to units in the next layer.
Input layer takes the raw data.
Right. Hidden layers do the intermediate processing, transforming the data through those weighted connections and activations. The output layer produces the final result, maybe a class prediction, a value, whatever the task is.
And for classification, you mentioned softmax for the output.
Yeah, if you have multiple exclusive classes, the output layer often uses a softmax function. It takes the raw scores for each class and turns them into a probability distribution so the outputs sum to one and represent the model's confidence in each class.
Okay. How does the calculation actually flow through the network, input to output?
That's called the forward pass or forward propagation. You feed the input values to the input layer. Then, for each unit in the next layer, you calculate its input, the weighted sum of the outputs from the previous layer plus the bias.
You give your wix wx plus b.
Exactly. Then you apply the activation function to that sum yi to get the unit's output a equals sz. This output a then becomes part of the input x for the next layer. You repeat this layer by layer until you reach the output layer.
Feed it forward layer by layer. So how does it learn? How do we get the weights and biases right?
That's the training process, usually supervised learning. You need labeled data input examples paired with the correct output. The goal is to adjust the weights and biases so the network's predictions on the training data get closer and closer to the true labels.
Oh.
You define a loss function, which measures the error or difference between the network's prediction and the true target. Common ones are mean squared error for regression or cross entropy for classification.
Cross entropy measures the difference between probability distributions.
Right. Then you use an optimization algorithm, almost always some form of gradient descent, to minimize this loss function. The core idea is to calculate the gradient of the loss with respect to each weight and bias in the network.
The gradient tells you which way to adjust the weights to decrease the loss.
Exactly. Backpropagation is the algorithm used to efficiently compute these gradients layer by layer, starting from the output and working backward. Once you have the gradients, you update each weight and bias by taking a small step in the opposite direction of its gradient, scaled by a learning rate.
Repeat many times with batches of data.
Yep. Iterate over the training data many times, epochs, until the loss stops decreasing significantly. The network has hopefully learned weights that make good predictions.
Okay. Now, how do neural networks apply to language modeling, which we discuss with n-grams? What are neural LMs?
Neural language models were a big leap forward. Instead of just counting n-grams, they use neural networks, often recurrent neural networks, RNNs initially, or now transformers, to predict the next word.
How do they work differently?
They typically start by converting words into those dense embeddings we talked about, like from word to vec, or learned jointly during LM training. The network then processes the sequence of input embeddings to predict the probability distribution over the entire vocabulary for the next word.
What are the advantages over n-grams?
Several big ones. They can capture much longer context because the network's internal state in RNNs, or attention mechanisms in transformers, can theoretically retain information from earlier in the sequence, overcoming the fixed window limitation of n-grams. They handle the curse of dimensionality better because they work with dense embeddings, sharing statistical strength between similar words.
So seeing the cat set helps predict Matt, but also helps if it sees the dog set, because cat and dog have similar embeddings.
Exactly. They generalize better based on semantic similarity. And as a side effect, you often get high-quality word embeddings out of training a neural LM.
Okay, powerful stuff. Let's move to Module 7, part of speech tagging. What's the goal here?
POS tagging is about assigning a grammatical category like noun, verb, adjective, etc. to each word in a sentence.
Labeling each word with its grammatical role, why is that useful?
It provides basic syntactic information. Knowing if a word is a noun or a verb is often crucial for understanding the sentence structure, which helps in many downstream tasks like parsing, information extraction, even machine translation. It's a fundamental building block.
What kind of tags are used? The notes mention tag sets.
Yeah, there are standard sets. A pentry bank tag set is very common for English.
Yeah,
it has tags like NN for singular noun, NNS for plural noun, VB for base form verb, VBD for past tense verb, JJ for adjective, DT for determiner, the IN and S for preposition, and so on. Maybe 30, 40 tags total.
Okay. And universal dependencies.
Universal dependencies, UD, aims for more cross-linguistic consistency. It has fewer tags, like just noun, vir, ADJ, ADV, DT, ADP. Adposition covers prepositions plus positions, PRO, etc. The goal is to make models more portable across languages.
Makes sense. The notes also distinguish open versus closed class words. What's that?
It's a linguistic distinction. Open classes are word types where new words are easily added to the language, nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs. Think of new tech terms or slang.
Okay, constantly growing.
Right. Closed classes have a mostly fixed, small set of members. New ones are rarely added. Think prepositions in, on, under, determiners, the, a, this, pronouns, he, she, they, conjunctions, and, but. This distinction can be useful for taggers.
How do we actually build a POS tagger automatically? The notes mention hidden Markov models, HMMs.
HMMs were a classic, very successful approach for POS tagging. They're a type of sequence model. The idea is that the sequence of POS tags is hidden, and we only observe the sequence of words.
So the tags generate the words?
Kind of. The model assumes two things. First, the probability of a tag depends only on the previous tag, the Markov assumption. So ptaggy tag 1 dot taggy dash 1 tag, ptaggy taggy 1.
Tag sequence has Markov property.
Right. Second, the probability of a word depends only on its own tag, not on other words or other tags, the output independence assumption. P-wordy all tags, all other words. P-wordy taggy.
Word depends only on its tag. Okay, so what parameters does an HMM need?
Three main sets of probabilities learned from tag training data. Transition probabilities, P-taggy, taggy one. Probability of tag B following tag A. Emission probabilities. P wordy taggy, probability of tag A emitting word X. Initial probabilities, P tag 1, probability of starting a sentence with tag A.
And once you have these probabilities,
you use an algorithm like the Viterbi algorithm. Given an observed sentence sequence of words, Viterbi efficiently finds the single most likely sequence of hidden tags that could have generated that sentence, according to the HMM parameters.
Finds the best tag sequence. The notes also mention beam search.
Yes. Viterbi finds the guaranteed optimal sequence, but can be computationally intensive. Beam search is a faster approximate alternative. Instead of keeping track of the best path to every possible state at each step, it only keeps track of the most probable paths, the beam.
So it prunes less likely paths to save computation.
Exactly. It's a heuristic. Might not find the absolute best path, but often finds a very good one much faster, especially with large tag sets or long sentences.
Okay. One last thing on POS tagging. How do we handle words the tagger hasn't seen during training? Unknown words.
That's a crucial problem. Since the emission probabilities, P, word tag, are learned from training data, an unknown word has zero probability for all tags initially. We need strategies to guess.
Like what?
We can use word shape features. Does it start with a capital letter? Likely a proper noun. Does it contain numbers, hyphens? Also, morphology, especially suffixes.
Like acking suggests a verb, ackingly, an adverb.
Precisely. A-E for past tense verb. S for plural noun or present tense verb, able for adjective. You can build models specifically for guessing tags based on suffixes or other character patterns. Context is also key. The tags of surrounding known words give strong clues.
Word after the is likely a noun or adjective.
Exactly. Combine all these clues, shape, morphology, context, to make an educated guess for unknown words.
Right. Makes the tagger more robust. Okay, moving on. Module 8, RNNs and transformers. We touched on RNNs for language models. What are their main limitations again?
So recurrent neural networks, while great for sequences, have issues. Training can be slow because they process sequentially. You need the output of step T1 to compute step T. Parallelization is hard.
And the bigger problem, long-range dependencies.
Yes, the vanishing gradient problem. When training with bat propagation through time, gradients can shrink exponentially as they flow back through many steps. This makes it hard for the model to learn connections between words that are far apart in the sequence. Exploding gradients, getting too large, can also happen.
LSTMs and GRUs helped with vanishing gradients, but weren't a perfect fix.
They helped a lot by introducing gating mechanisms to control information flow, but they can still struggle with very long dependencies and remain inherently sequential.
Which led to the transformer, What's the core idea there? How does it break away from recurrence?
The transformer architecture completely ditches recurrence. It relies entirely on a mechanism called self-attention.
Self-attention, what does that let it do?
It allows the model, when processing a word, to directly look at and weigh the importance of all other words in the input sequence, regardless of their distance. It builds connections based on relevance, not just position.
So no more step-by-step processing. It looks at the whole sentence at once.
Essentially, yes, for each layer. A transformer is typically stacks of identical blocks. Each block has a self-attention layer, then a feed-forward network layer with some normalization and residual connections thrown in. The self-attention is the key innovation for modeling dependencies.
Okay, how does self-attention actually work? What's happening mathematically?
All right, for each input word embedding, the self-attention layer creates three vectors using learned weight matrices. A query vector, Q, a key vector, K, and a value vector, V.
Q, K, V for every word.
Yep. Then, to calculate the attention score for a specific word, let's say word I, you take its query vector, key, and compute a similarity score with the key vector of every other word, KJ, including itself. Usually this is done using a scale dot product, key KJ score dimension.
Compare the query of one word to the keys of all words.
Right. These scores tell you how relevant each word J is to word I. You then pass these scores through a softmax function to get attention weights probabilities that sum to one.
So weights representing importance of other words for this word.
Exactly. Finally, the output representation for word I is a weighted sum of all the value vectors, VJ, in the sequence, using those attention weights. So each word's output representation is a blend of information from the entire sequence, weighted by learned relevance.
Wow. That's very different from RNNs passing hidden states along. What are the big advantages of this?
Two main ones. First, parallelization. Since the attention calculation between any two words doesn't depend on other steps, you can compute all attention scores and outputs for a layer simultaneously. Much faster training on parallel hardware like GPUs.
Big speed up.
And second,
direct modeling of long-range dependencies. The path length between any two words in the sequence via the attention mechanism is constant, effectively one lie. Information doesn't have to flow sequentially through many steps like in an RNN, so dependencies across long distances are much easier to capture.
Makes sense. The notes also mention multi-headed attention. What's that about? Multiple attention calculations in parallel.
Kind of, yeah. Instead of just one set of Q, K, V matrices, multi-head attention uses multiple sets, say 8 or 12 heads. Each head learns different Q, K, V projections and performs the attention calculation independently.
Why? What's the benefit of multiple heads? It allows the model to jointly attend to information from different representation subspaces at different positions. Basically, different heads can learn to focus on different kinds of relationships. Maybe one head focuses on syntactic dependencies, another on semantic similarity, another on relative positions.
So it captures richer, more diverse types of relationships simultaneously.
Exactly. The outputs from all the heads are then concatenated and linearly transformed to produce the final output for that multi-head attention layer. It gives the model more flexibility and power.
Okay, transformers sound incredibly powerful. Let's move to Module 9. Encoders and decoders. This architecture comes up a lot, especially for tasks like translation. Why is the structure useful?
The encoder-decoder framework is really good for sequence-to-sequence CC's tasks, where you need to map an input sequence to an output sequence, and crucially, the lengths might be different.
Like translating a sentence or summarizing an article?
Perfect examples. Or even question answering where the answer is generated text. You need one part to understand the input, the encoder, and another part to generate the output, the decoder.
So what's the encoder's job specifically?
The encoder takes the input sequence, like the source sentence in translation, and processes it, aiming to compress its meaning into one or more representations. Often the goal is to produce a final fixed-length vector called the context vector or thought vector that supposedly summarizes the entire input.
A summary of the input's meaning?
Right. It encodes the source information into a format the decoder can use.
What kind of networks are used as encoders?
Historically, RNNs like LSTMs or GRUs were common, often bidirectional ones, reading the input forwards and backwards, to get better context. More recently, transformer encoders, like in the original transformer paper or models like BERT, are state-of-the-art. They produce contextualized embeddings for each input token.
Okay, then we have the decoder. What does it do?
The decoder takes the encoder's output, typically that context vector, or access to all the encoder's hidden states, and generates the output sequence, one token at a time.
One word at a time.
Usually, yeah. It's typically autoregressive, meaning to generate the word at step T. It looks at the context from the encoder and the words it has already generated at steps 1 to T1.
So its own previous outputs feed back in as inputs for the next step.
Exactly. It keeps generating tokens until it produces a special end-of-sequence token.
You mentioned the context vector again. How does that work as the initial memory for the decoder?
In the simplest encoder-decoder models, especially older RNN-based ones, the final hidden state of the encoder serves as the context vector. This single vector is then used as the initial hidden state for the decoder RNN.
So the decoder starts with this summary of the input.
Right, but there's a problem. Trying to cram the meaning of a potentially very long input sentence into one fixed length vector is a huge bottleneck. Information gets lost, especially for longer inputs.
The single vector can't hold everything.
Exactly. This is where the attention mechanism, which we discussed with transformers but was actually first developed for RNN-based CITO-SIC models, comes in.
Ah, attention saves the day again. How does it help the decoder?
Instead of just relying on the single final context vector, attention allows the decoder, at each step of generating an output word, to look back at all the hidden states, or output embeddings, produced by the encoder for the entire input sequence.
It can access the encoder state for every input word.
Yes. It calculates attention weights, indicating which parts of the input sequence are most relevant for generating the current output word. It then computes a weighted average of the encoder states based on these weights. This creates a dynamic context vector tailored for each decoding step.
So the context changes depending on what word it's trying to generate next?
Precisely. It allows the decoder to focus on relevant parts of the input, overcoming the bottleneck and dramatically improving performance, especially for long sequences and tasks like translation where alignment matters.
Attention seems crucial. Okay, Module 10, bidirectional encoders and fine-tuning. We said standard LMs predict left to right. Bidirectional encoders like BERT look both ways. Why can't we just train BERT like a standard LM?
Good question. Think about it. If BERT is bidirectional, it can see the whole sentence at once. If you trained it to predict the next word, say word I, using both contexts before and after I, well, it already sees word in its input.
Oh, right. It could just copy the answer. That's cheating.
Exactly. It wouldn't learn anything meaningful about language structure or context. It would just learn to copy. Yeah. So you need a different pre-training task for bidirectional models.
Which is?
Masked language modeling, MLM. This is BERT's main pre-training objective. You take the input sentence, randomly mask out about 15% of the words, replace them with a special mask token.
Hide some of the words.
Right. And the model's task is to predict the original word that was in the mask position, using the surrounding unmasked words, both left and right context, to figure it out.
Uh-huh. So it has to understand the bidirectional context to fill in the blank correctly. It can't just cheat.
Exactly. This forces it to learn really rich, deep, contextualized representations of language. BERT also uses a second task called next sentence prediction, NSP. During pre-training, predicting if two sentences were originally consecutive, but MLM is the core idea for learning those bidirectional representations.
Clever. Now, after these huge models like BERT are pre-trained on massive text datasets using MLM, we usually fine-tune them for specific tasks. What is fine-tuning?
Fine-tuning is taking that pre-trained model with all its general language knowledge baked into its weights and then doing a bit more training on a smaller task-specific labeled dataset.
Like a dataset for sentiment analysis or question answering.
Exactly. You typically add a small new layer or layers on top of the pre-trained model specific to your task's output, e.g. a classification layer for sentiment. Then you train the whole thing, or maybe just the top layers, on your task data, usually with a much smaller learning rate than during pre-training.
Why do this? Why not just train a model from scratch for sentiment analysis?
Huge advantages to fine-tuning. First, you leverage all the general linguistic knowledge the model learned during pre-training. That's a massive head start compared to random initialization.
So you need less task-specific data.
Much less, typically. Which is great because labeled data is often expensive or hard to get. Fine-tuned models usually achieve much better performance, often state-of-the-art, especially on smaller data sets. They also tend to train faster, converge quicker, and generalize better because they start with a solid understanding of language.
Makes a lot of sense. Leverage the giant pre-trained brain. The notes also mention prompting as an alternative. What's that?
Prompting is a different way to use these powerful pre-trained LMs, especially the really large ones like GPT-3 and beyond. Mm-hmm. Instead of fine-tuning the model's weights, you give the model a carefully crafted text input, the prompt, that guides it to perform the task you want.
You frame the task as text completion.
Essentially, yes. For example, for sentiment analysis, your prompt might be review. This movie was fantastic. Sentiment, positive. Review, this movie was terrible. Sentiment, and the model completes it with negative.
You give it examples in the prompt itself.
You can. That's few-shot prompting with a few examples, or one-shot, one example, or even zero-shot, no examples, just instructions. Instruction tuning trains models specifically to follow natural language instructions and prompts. There's also chain-of-thought prompting, where you show the model reasoning steps in the examples to encourage it to think step-by-step. It's a rapidly evolving area.
Fascinating. Okay, Module 11, machine translation. What makes translation so hard for machines, linguistically speaking?
Oh, so many challenges. Syntax is a big one. Word order differs dramatically. English, SVO, subject, verb, object. Japanese, SOV, Irish, VSO. Plus where adjective go, etc.
Morphology, too. How words are built.
Definitely. Some languages pack tons of meaning into single words with lots of endings, inflections. Others use more separate words. Translating between them is tricky. The lexicon, the vocabulary, is another hurdle.
One word, many meanings.
Yep. Ambiguity. One word in language A might have five possible translations in language B, depending on context, plus idioms, cultural references, grammatical gender mismatches. It's complex.
The notes mention statistical machine translation, SMT, as an older approach. What was the idea there?
SMT treated translation as finding the most probable target sentence given a source sentence based on statistics learned from huge parallel corpora texts aligned with their translation.
Based on probabilities.
Yes. Phrase-based SMT was common. It learned probabilities of source phrases translating to target phrases and combined that with a target language model to ensure fluency, using complex decoding algorithms to find the best overall translation.
And now, neural machine translation, NMT, is dominant, using encoder decoders with attention.
Yes, NMT took over because it generally produces much better translations. The encoder decoder structure, especially with attention, can capture the meaning of the whole source sentence better, handle long-range dependencies, and deal with word reordering more naturally in SMT's piecemeal phrase approach.
The end-to-end learning helps.
Big time. NMT learns directly to optimize translation quality, often leading to more fluent, grammatical, and accurate output.
How do we evaluate if a translation is good?
Two main ways, manual and automatic. Manual evaluation uses human judges to rate translations on adequacy, meaning preservation, and fluency, naturalness. It's a gold standard, but slow and expensive.
So we need automatic metrics, BLEU.
BLEU, Bilingual Evaluation Understudy, is the most famous automatic metric. It compares the machine translation against one or more human reference translations.
How does it compare them?
It measures n-gram precision. It counts how many unigrams, bigrams, trigrams, and fourgrams from the machine translation also appear in any of the reference translations.
So how much overlap is there in short phrases?
Basically, yes. It calculates precision for each n-gram length, 1 to 4, averages them geometrically, and then applies a brevity penalty to punish translations that are too short compared to the references. Higher BLEU score, 0 to 100, means more overlap.
What are the pros and cons of BLEU?
Pros. It's automatic, fast, cheap, language independent, and correlates reasonably well with human judgments at the corpus level, not always sentence level. Cons. It doesn't handle synonyms or different phrasing well. If it's not in the references, it doesn't count. It's just precision-based, ignores recall. All words count equally. Sensitive to tokenization choices. It's far from perfect, but widely used.
Good overview. Okay, almost there. Module 12, dialogue systems and question answering. First, dialogue systems. What characterizes human conversation?
Key things are turn-taking. We speak one after another mostly. Grounding, making sure we understand each other. Using dialogue acts like requesting, informing, promising, and maintaining coherence and context.
How do we build chatbots that try to mimic this?
Different approaches. Rule-based systems, like old-school Eliza, use handcrafted patterns. Retrieval-based systems search a database of pre-written responses or dialogue turns and pick the best match for the user's input, often using vector similarity.
Find the closest existing answer.
Right. And then there are generation-based systems, using C2SIC models or large language models, which generate responses from scratch, word by word. These are much more flexible, but harder to control.
Now, question answering QA, what are the main approaches?
Two broad types. IR-based QA, information retrieval, finds relevant text passages from a large collection, like the web or Wikipedia, and then extracts the specific answer span from those passages.
Find the document, then find the answer within it.
Yep. The other is knowledge-based QA, which tries to answer questions by querying a structured knowledge base, like a database or a knowledge graph. It translates the natural language question into a formal query.
Let's focus on the IR-based pipeline. What are the steps?
First, question processing. Analyze the question. What keywords are important? What type of answer is expected? Person, date, location, number. Formulate a query for the retrieval system.
Understand the question, then.
Document passage retrieval. Use the query to find relevant documents from the collection. This might use classic techniques like TF-IDF and inverted indexes, or modern dense retrieval with embeddings like Phase for efficient similarity search. Often, you break documents into smaller passages.
Get relevant text snippets. Final step.
Answer extraction. Go through the retrieved passages and identify the specific span of text that most likely answers the question. This is often treated as a machine reading comprehension task, predicting the start and end tokens of the answer span.
Okay, so we might get multiple candidate answer spans. How do we pick the best one?
Answer ranking. We score the candidate answers using various features, like how much do the question words overlap with the answer? Does the answer match the expected type? For G, is it a person's name if the question asked who? How highly ranked was the document it came from? How close were the answer words to the question words in the passage? Machine learning models are often trained to combine these features and predict a final confidence score for ranking.
Got it. And how do we evaluate QA systems?
Common metrics are exact match, EM. Did the predicted answer string exactly match the ground truth answer? And token F1 score, which measures the overlap in words between the prediction and the ground truth, giving partial credit. For systems returning ranked lists, mean reciprocal rank, MRR, is used. It measures how high up the list the first correct answer appears, averaged over many questions.
Okay, last module. Module 13, parsing. Understanding sentence structure, right?
Exactly. Analyzing a sentence according to a grammar to figure out its syntactic structure. Two main flavors in your notes: constituency parsing and dependency parsing.
What's the core difference in how they view structure?
Constituency parsing breaks sentences down into nested chunks or phrases, constituents, noun phrases, verb phrases, etc. It shows a hierarchical grouping. The output is a tree structure, a parse tree.
Okay, phrase structure and dependency.
Dependency parsing focuses on the relationships between individual words. It shows which word modifies or depends on which other word, head-dependent relations. The output is usually a dependency graph or tree, where words or nodes and labeled arcs show the grammatical relations like subject-object modifier.
Let's start with constituency parsing, goal and output.
Goal is to identify these constituents and how they nest. The output parse tree shows this hierarchy, with the sentence at the root, branching down to phrases and finally to individual words at the leaves. It reveals the phrase structure grammar of the sentence.
Advantages and disadvantages.
Advantages. Rich hierarchical structure, useful for grammar checking, aligns with some linguistic theories. Good tree bank resources exist. Disadvantages. Can struggle with ambiguity, multiple possible trees for one sentence. Manually building comprehensive grammars is hard. Coverage versus overgeneration issues.
How are they implemented?
Traditionally using context-free grammars, CFGs, and parsing algorithms like CKY, which needs the grammar in Chomsky normal form. Probabilistic CFGs, PCFGs, add probabilities to rules to find the most likely parse. Nowadays, neural parsers, often span-based and using pre-trained embeddings, achieve state-of-the-art results by learning to score constituents directly.
Okay. Now, dependency parsing, goal and output.
Goal is to identify the head modifier relationships between words. Output is the dependency graph tree showing these directed, labeled links between words. It highlights the functional structure.
What makes a good dependency tree?
Usually a single root, often the main verb. Every other word has exactly one incoming arc, one head. There's a unique path from the root to every word. It's connected and acyclic.
Advantages, disadvantages versus constituency.
Advantages. Directly shows grammatical relations, often better for free word order languages, approximates semantic roles. Disadvantages. Basic methods might struggle with non-projective structures, doesn't explicitly show phrasal constituents.
How are dependency parsers built?
Two main styles. Transition-based parsers use a state machine with stack, buffer, and classifiers to predict a sequence of actions, shift left arc, right arc, to build the tree incrementally. Graph-based parsers define a score for all possible trees and use algorithms, like max spanning tree algorithms, to find the globally highest scoring tree. Neural networks are heavily used in both approaches now.
Final definition, projective versus non-projective dependency trees.
A dependency tree is projective if, when you draw the arcs above the sentence, no arcs cross each other. Non-projective trees have crossing arcs.
Why does it matter?
Some grammatical constructions, especially in languages with flexible word order, require non-projective arcs for accurate analysis. Simpler transition-based parsers often can only produce projective trees, while graph-based methods can handle non-projectivity more easily.
Wow! Okay, that seems to cover parsing in detail. And that brings us to the end of the modules.
We made it! That was a comprehensive tour through all the key concepts from those NLP notes.
Absolutely. We went from classification and sentiment through language models, vectors, neural nets, sequence models like RNNs and transformers, translation, dialogue, QA, and finally parsing. Hopefully it's all a bit clearer now and you can see how these ideas connect.
Yeah, things like classification and language modeling are foundational, and they underpin the more complex applications like translation or dialogue systems. Understanding the basics really helps.
We really hope this deep dive has given you a solid framework for tackling that final exam. You've got the knowledge distilled now.
Definitely. Reread your notes with these connections in mind, and you should be in great shape.
All right. To leave you with something to think about as you finish your prep, considering all the progress we've discussed today, from basic n-grams to complex transformers, what do you think will be the next major breakthrough in how machines truly understand and interact with human language?
Ooh, good question to ponder. Best of luck with the final.